This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome. This is PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, the searing attack on the President by his former Defence Secretary Jim Mattis, who calls for mature leadership in the United States. Here, the government's got $25,000 to give away for home renovations, but the rules mean only a few will benefit.
Judging by the amount of inquiry we've had over the past few weeks in the anticipation of getting this grant, we've had a huge influx. We're probably getting 8 to 10 a day now.
It's really targeted towards people who already have relatively secure housing.
And after safety concerns saw a trial of Donald Trump's favoured COVID-19 therapy pulled last week, why has the World Health Organization now decided the trial is back on again? The former Marine Corps General James Mattis has been criticised in the past for not saying enough about his time as US Defence Secretary under Donald Trump. But he certainly couldn't be accused of holding back in his critique today of the President's response to the current nationwide protests. In a blistering attack, Jim Mattis said he was angry and appalled by the events of the past days and accused the President of sowing division and lacking mature leadership. The comments come against a backdrop of simmering tensions between the White House and the armed forces over Donald Trump's threat to send in the military to restore order as protests escalate into a ninth night over the death of an unarmed black man in police custody. Barbara Miller has our report.
As night fell, Seattle looked a little like Hong Kong. Those at the front of a protest line kneeled down under colourful umbrellas, put up to protect them against a possible dousing in pepper spray. In Washington, they sang into the evening. In New York, as in many cities across the US, there was chanting on a ninth night of protest at the death in police custody of George Floyd. And there were words of encouragement from a former president, Barack Obama.
You have helped to make the entire country feel as if this is something that's got to change. You've communicated a sense of urgency that is as powerful and as transformative as anything that I've seen in recent years.
There has been vandalism and looting too, and the current president angrily retweeted a video mashup accusing mainstream media of underreporting the violence.
It's been a mostly peaceful protest, but then they chose to move in.
Many of these protests have been largely peaceful.
Mostly peaceful.
Mostly peaceful.
Mostly peaceful.
Donald Trump wasn't just angry at the media, but at these comments from his defense secretary, Mark Esper, rejecting the president's suggestion that a 200-year-old Act could be invoked to allow the military to be deployed to the nation's streets.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now. I do not support invoking the Insurrection Act.
It's understood that didn't go down too well with the president. His press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, was asked if Mark Esper still had Donald Trump's confidence.
As of right now, Secretary Esper is still Secretary Esper, and should the president lose faith, we will all learn about that in the future.
Later, in a sign that he perhaps recognized he'd gone too far, Mark Esper backed down on a decision to send home active army units sent to Washington to deal with the unrest. James Brown is a visiting fellow at the U.S. Studies Centre at the University of Sydney and a former Australian Army officer.
The president's shown that he doesn't like criticism from members of his senior leadership group. The press secretary of the White House was asked whether Mark Esper still had the president's confidence, and she said he does for now. But Mark Esper is in a tenuous position. He knows that the president overreached. He is concerned about what the president might try to do with the military and where that might lead this situation, and whether he can remain in his position, I think is something he would be considering at the moment, and the president would certainly be considering it.
President Trump's threat to deploy the military has unsettled the top brass. It prompted General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to send an all-staff memo reaffirming that the US military supports and defends the constitutional right to freedom of speech and peaceful assembly. A former defense secretary has been far more blunt in his response.
And now, breaking from the Atlantic, the former secretary of defense, James Mattis, General James Mattis, who has barely spoken out, or rarely spoken out, I should say, has come out with this blistering condemnation of Trump.
In the piece, James Mattis said the president was deliberately dividing the nation and lacked mature leadership. Jim Mattis said he'd never seen anything like it, and the nation could unite without the president. James Brown again.
I think the silence from Jim Mattis has been deafening. There's a lot of people that wanted him to speak out when he resigned in a more forceful way. For him to wait until this moment to denounce the president is significant. But unless it's joined by voices from the Republican Party and from the president's colleagues, it will ultimately be meaningless.
And over the next few days, how do you see it playing out? I mean, at the press secretary in that same media conference you mentioned reiterated that the president could call out the military but hadn't done so. Do you think he's sort of backing away from the idea that he might take that step?
He would have advisors around him now saying, take your time, don't pour petrol on the flames, wait and see if it's necessary. But he loves to appear to be the strong man. He loves to play to that role of the commander-in-chief. And for his base, they expect him to take strong and decisive action to stop the looting of stores and the assaults that are taking place alongside lawful and peaceful protest.
Donald Trump responded to James Mattis's comments on Twitter. Glad he is gone, he wrote.
Barbara Miller with that report. Well, at least one US police department has announced a review of how it operates in response to the protests. The Los Angeles Police Department wants changes by the end of the year, and the department's board wants a report on protesters injured during the demonstrations in that city this past week. There have also been images among the violence this week of police standing with protesters rather than fighting them. So is this the beginning of real change? Associate Professor Claire Corbould is an expert in African American history and politics at Deakin University in Melbourne. We spoke earlier.
I must say I'm a bit sceptical about those incidences and whether they amount to much more than a PR stunt. But there have been some encouraging signs over the last few years in the United States of just a few incidences. So Camden in New Jersey, for example, has shifted in the last 7 years from a military model of policing, which is what we see in most of the United States, to a community model of policing. And they've done that by shifting the administration from the state to the county, by completely renewing the personnel, by defunding and changing, so literally giving them less equipment and less of that incredible military gear that we see so many American policemen kitted out in, and most of all by retraining or training anew the new force with the dictum, first principle, do not use force unless it is absolutely necessary, and making sure that the definition of necessary is one that a reasonable person would agree with. And so that's a kind of encouraging sign, but there aren't many. The LAPD today it's been announced that the LA City Council will cut their budget from $1.8 billion by $150 million. I mean, I'm talking about big numbers in any case, but that's actually quite significant too. So it's hard to know, but and you know, we hope that these protests will make a big change in policing in the United States.
It's not just policing either, is it? The criminal justice system more broadly has a lot of issues to deal with.
Indeed. I mean, at every level, police are just the front line African Americans encounter, you know, on a daily basis. But no, I mean, it's the way that laws are framed, and the example that historians like me use all the time is in the 1980s, crack cocaine, the possession or use of crack cocaine was much more harshly penalised than the use of powdered cocaine. And of course, it was white people who used powdered cocaine by and large, and African Americans who used crack cocaine. So examples like the passing of laws, and then who gets to court, who gets to settle out of court, who gets convicted, and how long prison sentences and the like. At every level, African Americans are discriminated against. And that's why we see a hugely disproportionate number of African Americans in prison in the United States. So the prison population is 2.3 million. And this is a system that has made a lot of other people an awful lot of money.
Now, on the protests themselves, the ninth night of protests across the United States, indeed protests around the world, is this moment actually changing votes? And whose votes? I mean, is it really so pivotal that it might shift a presidential election?
Always difficult to predict the future, but this morning Newsweek published a poll that shows that of Minneapolis residents, 54% said they understood and felt that it was justified that protesters had burned down the police precinct. And a massive 78% said that they understood the anger that was underpinning these protests and the longevity of these protests. I mean, that is unprecedented. If you go back to King and the civil rights campaigns of the 1960s, I mean, it's said now that King was the most hated man in America. And certainly polls taken in the mid and late 1960s showed that most moderate whites, let alone conservatives, thought King was, you know, terrible, the Antichrist, that he was asking for too much too soon and was unreasonable. So to have a poll like that this morning is, you know, again, another sign of hope and quite significant. Whether it translates to votes, of course, is always a vexed question because there's no compulsory voting. So it will take the mobilisation, particularly of young people and of African Americans, to ensure Biden a victory.
Claire Corbould, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Linda.
Associate Professor Claire Corbould from Deakin University. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram on Twitter. I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, attacks on reporters and mistrust in the mainstream media. What's driving it and can it be turned around?
You won't change their mind. You won't be able to explain to them that, hey, actually, there's independent evidence. They won't care. They will just label it fake news and whatever it is. They will not be swayed by evidence.
Well, in the midst of so many disruptive events globally, stock markets are booming. One prominent financial columnist has called it the most hated rally in history, as some make gains while others face enormous hardship. Our business reporter David Taylor has been meeting two people on either side of the divide.
Henry Jennings reckons the coronavirus crisis has left him, well, better off.
Sometimes fortune favours the brave. Some people would call us lucky. I'd rather say that it was where planning and opportunity came together.
Henry Jennings writes for a share market newsletter and trades on the side. He's ridden the recent big lift in stock prices, boosting his own personal wealth, while he says subscriptions to his newsletter have increased substantially.
Our strategy and our nimbleness has paid off, and as a result, we've attracted some good numbers in terms of subscribers, which is always pretty pleasant.
The stock market rally itself is being described by some as the most hated rally in history. The ASX 200, for example, is now up an impressive 35% since its lows in March. It's still down 15 to 20% from its recent peak in February. Enormous amounts of government rescue money, combined with record low interest rates and billions in financial market stimulus, is seeing those with money piling into stocks.
Now, of course, the stock market is a forward-looking indicator, so we are anticipating green and pleasant conditions in the valley across the way in the future. The problem will come, of course, if we don't see that recovery in the economy as quickly as some hope.
40-year-old Nathan Collinson is one job seeker who's desperate to see an economic recovery that you might expect given the stock market's recent performance. He's been struggling to land a full-time job for close to a decade now, and the pandemic has only made that struggle harder.
I mean, that's the thing nowadays. You can send out like 100 or so applications and you don't get any responses. You're lucky to get, you know, thank you, or received your letter, or, you know, it's amazing if you even get the chance of a job interview nowadays. So there's absolutely no feedback. There's not a lot of suitable jobs.
And the outlook for job seekers is bleak. Treasury and several bank economists have the unemployment rate above 7% well into next year. And today's figures from the Bureau of Statistics showing a huge 17% fall in retail sales for April, and yesterday's news of Australia entering recession, don't paint an encouraging picture about the health of the economy.
It's Groundhog Day. Every day you get up and you try and, you know, look for work or, you know, keep yourself occupied, whatever. I mean, it's like very depressing, you know.
The Reserve Bank governor says he wants business to invest and shoppers to spend more money. That, he argues, will grow the economy and put more people in work. The government's rescue packages are also aimed at this idea. But policy think tank, the Grattan Institute, wants to challenge this. Household Finances Program Director Brendan Coates says simply asking businesses and consumers to spend more will likely only benefit those who are already relatively well off.
So we're going to have to see more stimulus go into the economy, more cash payments, extra infrastructure spending in order to give households and businesses confidence that the recovery is going to be quick and that therefore they should open their wallets and contribute to it.
But again, Brendan Coates, even if there is an increase in spending and the economy moves forward as we define it, there will still be plenty of people who miss out and who can't benefit from that, what we define as economic growth. Is there a silver bullet for this in terms of policy? Tax reform, maybe?
I think what it means is a lot of people are going to struggle for a long time post-COVID. So the most important thing is making sure the supports stay in place for a long time. On the whole, then we've got to think about how to grow the economy coming out the other side. And that does probably mean structural reforms. It means tax reforms on the table, maybe industrial relations. But those are things that are really only going to take effect in the long term. The most important thing for the time being is getting unemployment down as quickly as we can. And that really means the government and the Reserve Bank have to do everything they possibly can to get that number down quickly so the Australians are back in jobs and have money to spend.
And there's no time to waste because, as job seeker Nathan Collinson explains, hitting your head up against a jobs market brick wall is no fun at all.
It really does affect your emotional health. You get a job interview, so you lift your spirits up, you put on a brave face, you put on a nice shirt, you know, you go in there, try and present well, and then they tell you that you're overqualified. And that just breaks your heart.
Job seeker Nathan Collinson, David Taylor with that report. Well, the federal government is touting its new $680 million home builder scheme as a boost for the construction sector as COVID-19 measures keep dragging on the economy. But critics have been out in force today saying it's a missed opportunity to fund building that delivers the greatest benefit. At the top of that list is social housing. Still, plenty are delighted at the number on offer, $25,000 apiece, but there are also plenty of rules on who'll get it. David Sparks has the latest.
Troy Tenhegler is a builder with 5 employees in the central Queensland town of Gladstone. With the government's new package now locked in, he thinks a boom in construction is on the way.
Judging by the amount of inquiry we've had over the past few weeks in the anticipation of getting this grant, greatly. We've had a huge influx of interest ringing up. And since in the last week where it's become more apparent that it's definitely going ahead, that's probably double. We're probably getting 8 to 10 a day now.
Are they mostly for new home builds or for renovations?
Just about everyone's for a new home build.
And some home buyers are already excited. One of them is Vivek Agrawal, who this morning signed a contract to build a new home in Melbourne's far north.
It's like a jackpot. You're winning a jackpot of 25 grand.
The federal government's home builder package offers $25,000 for people to build a new home or pay for a major upgrade of the home they live in. But there are a lot of rules. Single recipients must earn less than $125,000 a year, and the limit is $200,000 for couples. They must be spending at least $150,000 of their own money on the build and not more than $750,000. Scott Morrison says it will boost an industry that helps drive the Australian economy.
In the short term, we know that in the residential building construction industry, that on the other side of September, the pipeline of works that they've been working on will really start to drive quickly. Some 30,000 homes or thereabouts won't get built. And that's why we believed it was important that as part of the many measures, the many supports that we're putting into our economy at the moment, supporting our home building industry, to support those families and those Australians whose dream it was to build their home or to do that big renovation.
The government expects 27,000 homeowners or builders to access the scheme. The building industry says it will save jobs and pump life into the economy. But the federal opposition is not impressed. Shadow Housing Minister Jason Clare.
All of this hype about renovations, how you're going to be able to renovate your kitchen and renovate your bathroom. It turns out it's all rubbish. You know, there's not many battlers in the suburbs of Australia that have got a lazy $150,000 to renovate their kitchen or their bathroom.
Experts say the scheme is a welcome injection, but there are critics. Associate Professor Vito Malika from the Macquarie University Business School says with $688 million up for grabs, the money could have been better targeted.
The reason why I'm critical of it is it's not going to start new works. This $25,000 handout is going to be given for people that most likely already have approval to complete $150,000 renovations. Construction has a huge multiplier effect on the rest of the economy, without a doubt. However, I think, you know, the money allocated for this stimulus could be allocated elsewhere.
Any suggestions?
I think if you were to get a new home to purchase a new home, right, reduce stamp duties, that would be a better outcome. To reduce the transaction costs of buying a home rather than stimulating people who already have got a home, have debt, and probably are going to take on further debt to renovate a home, $25,000 doesn't go a long way.
Another critic is Associate Professor Wendy Stone from Swinburne University.
What it does is not target adequately social housing construction or improvement. Here is an opportunity to both target the money towards social housing construction, which we need far more social housing. We need to adequately respond to the kind of housing quality and condition repairs that are required in a lot of social housing, in public housing, community housing, and in specialist Indigenous housing.
Associate Professor Wendy Stone from Swinburne University. David Sparks with that report. Well, remember hydroxychloroquine, Donald Trump's favoured COVID-19 therapy? Well, the World Health Organization has today resumed a trial of that drug after shutting it down last week when data was published backing concerns that the malaria drug can cause heart problems. Australian researchers will also resume their study of hydroxychloroquine after reviewing those same findings. Samantha Donovan has more.
Last week, the WHO decided to stop recruiting volunteers for its hydroxychloroquine study after the medical journal The Lancet published a study of 96,000 people. It concluded the drug didn't improve the survival rates of patients in hospital with COVID-19, and those patients were more likely to develop problems with their heart rhythm. But medical experts raised concerns about the data used in The Lancet study. After reviewing those figures, the WHO has decided there's no reason its trial shouldn't start up again. Dr. Soumya Swaminathan is the WHO's chief scientist. She says it's important clinical trials keep going.
As of now, there's no evidence that any drug actually reduces the mortality in patients who have COVID-19. And in fact, it's an urgent priority for all of us to do the needed studies, to do the randomized clinical trials in order to get that evidence as quickly as possible. We hope that the ongoing trials will continue till we have definitive answers, because that's what the world needs today.
In a decision unrelated to the WHO announcement, the committees overseeing the Australasian COVID-19 trial, known as ASCOT, have also decided to go ahead with the hydroxychloroquine arm of its study. Like the WHO, it had suspended patient recruitment while it reviewed the Lancet study data and findings. The trials of hydroxychloroquine in Australia and around the world are being watched by experts like Dr. Ian Musgrave, a senior lecturer in pharmacology at the University of Adelaide.
Very good that the WHO has started up again, but at the moment there is no strong evidence to suggest that we should be taking it for COVID-19.
Dr. Musgrave points to the results of another new study on hydroxychloroquine as a preventive measure that's just come out in the New England Journal of Medicine.
And now we know that in a test tube, hydroxychloroquine can prevent the virus from replicating in test tubes, and it might be better off as a preventative. However, this trial suggests that it's not going to be particularly effective, although we will need some more trials to really tease that out. We've got a big trial in Australia looking at whether or not hydroxychloroquine can prevent infection in healthcare workers who are at high risk.
Leading that trial is Professor Mark Pellegrini from the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research in Melbourne. Unlike the WHO, his team didn't stop recruiting for their hydroxychloroquine study, and he's pleased the World Health Body has decided to start its trial up again.
We decided not to interrupt the hydroxychloroquine prevention study, primarily because our study was a prevention study, so we're using hydroxychloroquine in people who are very healthy to try and prevent them from developing COVID-19. So we were not treating sick individuals like they were in the study that was performed in The Lancet.
Given the amount of interest in hydroxychloroquine around the world, are you feeling pressure to get your study going and come up with some results?
We all have to be incredibly careful and diligent about doing these trials. And if nothing else, that's a lesson that has been taught to us from the publications that are seeming to be rushed. We want the best trial to be done under the best circumstances. And I think the setting in Australia allows us to do that because we're not overwhelmed with COVID-19 and we've got the resources to put towards this clinical trial.
Professor Mark Pellegrini from the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, speaking with Samantha Donovan. Well, there's no let-up in the targeting of journalists doing their jobs around the world. Many cases go unseen by many of us. But scenes of police attacks on reporters in the US in particular have thrown a spotlight on the problem. And there are other perils for societies looking for the truth in difficult times, not least denialism, a refusal by some people to accept facts. Rhett Burney has this report.
Midway through a live report from London, Australian reporter Sophie Walsh begins to scream.
Descended into... Sorry.
Sophie, you okay?
Sorry. I just...
Sophie?
Yeah, I just had someone come up and try and... Yeah.
The man was quickly arrested. It's alleged he made threats to stab the Channel 9 reporter and he was carrying a weapon believed to be a screwdriver. Then, live on the same network this morning, this.
Guys, there's actually a bit of a clash with us here at the moment. And
reporter Ben Avery chased by an angry mob through London's city as protests over the death of George Floyd turned violent. In both cases, neither were physically injured. On social media, there was plenty of sympathy. But there were also many condoning the harassment of journalists. Among them, one user who wrote, "Good, stop spreading fake news," while others called the incidents a setup, despite the videoed violence.
You won't change their mind. You won't be able to explain to them that, hey, actually, there's independent evidence from various sources that there's these attacks going on. They won't care. They will just label it fake news and whatever it is. They will not be swayed by evidence.
That's Associate Professor Ulrich Ecker from the University of Western Australia's School of Psychological Science. He says there's a growing trend in social media users dismissing the facts, pointing to a surge in conspiracy theories around the COVID-19 pandemic, misinformation about 5G technology, claims by anti-vaccination groups, and climate change denial.
We have to acknowledge that we're in a very unusual situation here where there is a huge threat to people's health, their livelihood. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of conflicting information. It's very difficult to navigate the information that we receive. People have a desperate need to be reassured and to find information.
Dr. Justin Ellis is a lecturer in criminology at Newcastle University, and he's also worked in the media. He says distrust in mainstream media is increasing. The fight for audience numbers is driven by the need for advertising dollars, and he says that's created what's known as clickbait, sensational headlines designed to lure the public into paying to read or watch a news article.
So if you don't pay, all you get is the headline, and that's what you take away. And there's a huge risk here of misinforming the public because those headlines are not necessarily an accurate reflection of what's in the article.
Justin Ellis says social media platforms allow communities to come together no matter where they are in the world and share information relevant to them. He says that's often a good thing, but something mainstream media is struggling to tap into, making it hard to win the trust of audiences, even when the facts are there for all to see.
It moves really quickly. It has velocity on its side, and it's tribal. So I think mainstream media is still adhering to, I guess, stereotypes in the way that it reports things from a criminological point of view, racial profiling, and social media can very quickly counter-narrative that and counter-narrative, and we get this, what I call this oscillation effect.
Dr. Justin Ellis from Newcastle University, Rhett Burney, our reporter. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.